Hello, and welcome to the Scriptures Are Real podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about things in the Scriptures that have made them real to us so we can draw more power out of them because we need all the help we can get. I'm your host, Carrie Muhlstein, and I'm so happy to have with us Sherilyn Farns. Thanks for being with us, Sherilyn.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we're grateful you would be with us. Sherilyn, this is her first time on the podcast, so let me tell everyone a little bit about Sherilyn. She used to be on the Joseph Smith Papers Project, if I understand correctly. You tell me when I get this wrong, Sherilyn, but used to be on the Joseph Smith Papers Project and then went and got her PhD in historical studies, I think, especially in women and their place in early history of this country and the church. Am I getting that right? At Texas Christian University, right?
I did go to TCU, and focus was on borderlands, so border crossing and so Western Missouri, Jackson County, and then across the border into what becomes Kansas. So geographic,
fantastic.
Religious border crossing. But women are in there, so they're a part of it. So thanks for mentioning.
Okay, well, I must have misheard that somewhere. But anyway, and I will say that I encountered your work when I am a huge fan of Edward and Lydia Partridge, really huge fan, and I just can't get enough. And so as I was trying to find out, and I had some questions, okay, when did they do this? And one of the most valuable resources I found was a dissertation, and it happens to be your dissertation, and on the Partridge family. So we'll let you talk about that. And now, I think for 2 months now, you've been an assistant professor, so full-time faculty member in the Department of Church History and Doctrine in the same college I'm in here at BYU. And I think as of when we're recording, this first day of class is tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah. So yes, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so looking forward to it.
Well, what else should we know about you? And correct what I got wrong.
I wrote my master's thesis on Edward Partridge. And then
thesis. Okay, mm-hmm. Sorry.
Yeah, no, you're good. And because I love studying them so much and then studied Edward Partridge and then his wife and then his daughters and love the writings of his daughters, Eliza and Emily, I thought I want to understand the culture that they stepped into in Jackson County. So that's how I ended up with my dissertation on Western Missouri. But I, outside of that, I love playing pickleball. I love spending time with my family. I love being in the mountains. I actually laugh that a good portion of my dissertation was written up the canyons here in Utah because I just take my laptop, take a camp chair, and just go sit up there in the mountains and work on my dissertation. So I love
fantastic
I love Utah, and I'm thrilled to be assistant professor.
Nice. That's where this book here, let's talk about the Book of Abraham. I wrote most of that up the canyon that's just right up from my house. So yeah, that's... It's a nice way to go.
By the way, can I just say, I love that series, the Let's Talk About series. Yeah. It is phenomenal. So thank you for your part in contributing to it.
It was good fun. Anyway, well, this week is an interesting and wonderful set of revelations, as they always are. And we will encourage everyone again. We hope that we help you and are an aid to you in understanding the revelations. But you got to get into the scriptures to get into those revelations themselves. That's where the secret sauce is. And then we're just a little side dish. But we hope you'll get in there. But it's a fantastic set of revelations. But so much of this is also set around the history of what's been going on in Missouri. And we've been talking about that a little bit, but in many ways, working up to this day, where we will talk about the bubbling over, right? We've talked about the dedication of the land of Zion and the Partridges finding out, oh, surprise, you're going to stay here. And I've heard you quote letters from Edward Partridge that he wrote home to the folks in Painesville, and hopefully we can do that today or whatever you haven't planned. But we've set the scene a little bit. We've talked about the difficulty. Some people come and consecrate well. Some people don't consecrate. Some people come and take advantage of the system. Some people are kind of outside of the system and all of those difficulties. But really building up to this. So today's a day where both the revelations and the history can speak volumes. There's no way we can do as much of either one as either one of us would like. But what we can do, let's do it and have fun. I mean, it is when we get into the lives of these people that it becomes real. So let's make this real. Where would you like to start?
Yeah, I am super excited that you asked me to come and specifically talk about these sections because, we were talking a lot about Edward Partridge. But as I was looking at this group of sections, right, 98, 99, 100, and 101, the theme that really stood out to me was families, right? Mm-hmm. As we're talking about, there's an interesting quote from Joseph Smith, as he's talking about what's going on. We often talk about these sections as relating to the persecution in Missouri, but there's persecution in Kirtland. And so Joseph Smith, as he writes in his journal, he says, this man that's persecuting the church, Dr. Philastus Hurlbut, he says that this man sought the destruction of the saints, and more particularly myself and family. And then as the saints are kicked out of Jackson County, you have them looking for their families and making, you know, did my family get out? Did my neighbors get out? And then 99 and 100, of course, pertain to John Murdoch and taking care of his family.
Yeah. And then and John Murdoch's another hero of mine. So he and Edward Partridge are two of my favorite church history characters. Anyway, sorry, keep going.
No. We could talk about him for a long time on that, and I hope we get to talk about him. But yeah, and then Joseph Smith and Cindy Rigdon are worried about their families. And then Section 101, when the saints actually are forced out of Jackson County and they're on the borders, and the people are just, you know, where's my family? Is my family okay? As I was thinking about it, I was just thinking about really kind of the theme of your podcast, that the scriptures are real, that we may not be physically being kicked out of our homes, but yet we worry about our families and we care about our families, and whatever our family looks like. I'm not married. I don't have children, but I have siblings. I have nieces and nephew. I have parents. I have, you know, extended family. And that as I read the scriptures, often I find answers of what I can do to help build relationships with my family and to care for my family, even with things that aren't written there. But I love that these verses specifically are talking about how they can care about their families. So that was just, I just wanted to mention that. That was kind of something that just jumped out at me as I was thinking about these four sections altogether, kind of our bookends of persecutions, and then the two middle ones specifically directed towards how do you take care of your families.
Fantastic. And you're right. I hope not too many people, there are people somewhere right now who are being persecuted for being a member of the church, but hope not too many are going through some of what happened here. But there is some kind of difficulty, trial, different form of persecution or something that is happening for everyone in their family. And so I love that you're highlighting that will make it real as we look at these principles that will apply to us, even if we're not being tarred and feathered in Jackson County.
Yeah. But speaking of Jackson County, I thought it might be helpful to kind of step back and say, okay, what's the situation? What's going on here? And so we have DNC 52. So jumping back a ways, a couple years before, it's from June 6, 1831, and it calls Edward Partridge and others. You can see where my focus is. Calls Partridge and other people to go to Missouri. And yeah, like you mentioned, he writes this letter back, or I think you just referred to it, but he writes a letter back, you know, when I left, I had no intention of staying in Missouri, but surprise, he was called through Joseph Smith by the Lord to stay in Missouri. And so he writes this really poignant letter back to his wife in August of 1831, you know, dear Lydia, essentially, we've been asked to move here permanently. Can you pack up the house and our five daughters and move here this fall or whenever you think best? If you think best to come later, you know, come later. But will you come? And he says, we'll have to suffer some privations. You know, they had a pretty comfortable home in Painesville. Yeah. He was there. They had five daughters. And he says, we'll have to suffer some in ways that we hadn't been, you know, accustomed to. But I think he's talking about lack of material possessions and comforts, you know, not knowing, of course, the persecution that would come. He's pretty well respected in Painesville. And so it is quite a shock to get to Missouri and to, you know, just have a different environment. And, you know, you probably talked some about this already, but it's right on the edge of the kind of the settled part of the United States.
Yeah.
And so it's more of a frontier town. Some people that visited said, oh, it's like a century behind the times. There are, you know, stores, they have things, but it's not quite settled the same way that Painesville or anywhere back east is, you know, so with the creature comforts that a lot of them were used to. And so the saints start moving there in the summer of 1831, and tensions start to build. There's conflicts, there's economic conflicts, there's political conflicts. The saints are mostly, you know, Northerners and more against slavery. And then religiously, they are, you know, believing in a prophet, they're believing in new scripture. And so they start having a lot of conflicts with the Missouri settlers who are there. And this kind of, you know, as you know, like bubbles over in the summer of 1833 with Edward Partridge being tarred and feathered. And we can jump in. We can tell that story for a little bit, if that's okay.
Yeah, let's do it. And maybe I'll just kind of remind our audience, some of these stories I did a little bit on our Patreon website, but mostly we've done them here. But to tie two together, as you talk about Edward Partridge going down, that's when, and you mentioned Section 52, when we had all these sets of missionaries. They were called to go down there together, and Joseph is going with Sidney, but they end up going a bit with Edward and with, is it Ezra Booth, I think, is with them. In any case, the other part of this story, and I read some of his journal account from this, Hiram and John Murdoch are called to go, but they go and preach to some of the Smith family in Detroit. And then on their way down, this is when they go through these swamps and everything, and they get sick. So they miss the whole dedication and everything. And as Joseph and company are leaving, John and Hiram are finally arriving, they cross paths. But that's the story of setting it up that my audience might remember. And then we have this long time of just trying to get Zion going. One of the things I've just am passionate about this year, I'm trying to help people understand the Missouri era and how it integrates with the Kirtland era. We kind of think of them as two separate things, but they are happening together. So you've got the School of the Prophets and some of the presidency down in Missouri are up for the School of the Prophets and things like that. So they're constantly going back and forth. Sometimes Joseph and others coming from, and we've had a couple of revelations coming from Ohio down into Missouri, but more leaders in Missouri going up to Ohio. But you've had this 2-year struggle of trying to get consecrated finances down there to buy land for all the saints who are showing up. And as I said, some within the system and some bucking the system. But all of that has added to what you are talking about. And also that cultural contrast. I can't remember where, but I remember one time reading, I think it was one of the settlers that were already in Missouri. And I'd actually, I'll pause, all right, if for a minute, if it's okay, and ask something that I've heard and understood and even talked about on this podcast. But given your dissertation topic, you will be the one to tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, that because that Jackson County independence is like right there on the border of not the United States anymore, that you have kind of some rough crowd there that can hop across the border if there are problems and escape being within the territory. And so it just lends itself to being a little bit of a rough crowd because it is a border town. Is that mm-hmm. accurate or?
Yes. Yeah. So technically the U.S. has purchased it about 30 years earlier with the Louisiana Purchase, but you're exactly right in that people would cross the border because what's just to the west of Independence in Jackson County is American Indian Reserves is there at the time, and the rules are completely different. And so, yeah, if the federal agents come to town, then there was a contingent. We have, I think, I haven't looked it up recently, but I think that's a Protestant missionary in 1832 or so that writes that comment that he says that those people, you know, will then slip across the border if they're trying to avoid the law, and then wait, the law leaves, and then come back into Independence. So yeah, it's considered much rougher. The descriptions at the time period describe, you know, gambling and swearing and prostitution and drinking and all sorts of things, horse racing, cockfighting, especially on Sundays. They're like, this is what these people do. I mean, there's good, you know, church abiding or church going people as well, but it is very much a frontier town in the way we usually use that word.
It's kind of the wild west of their day.
Yes. The first county clerk, I believe it is, he actually came from just the neighboring county when Jackson County is just barely formed, 1825, 1826. So a few years earlier, the first county, I think it's the county clerk, he actually resigns his position in disgust because of like the low moral character of the people of this county. He's like, I can't work with this. Just says, no, I'm not going to work with this, and just leaves, which is fascinating that just one county over. But I think I'm glad you bring up that point because they're just on the border.
And I have this memory of reading an account from one of the settlers that was already there that says that you couldn't find two cultural classes more different from each other and less suited to living with each other. Am I remembering something accurate here? Or?
Yes. Yeah, I believe it's one of the McCoys that says that they're just so clashing. Alex Baugh, who's our phenomenal Missouri best expert on Missouri, says they're like oil and water. It's just you know, other intersections. Yes. You know, does Lydia Partridge make friends? And, you know, one of her daughters writes, oh, she made friends and her friend gave her a bonnet that she wore. And, you know, there's exchanges and commercial exchanges.
Yeah. Edward seems to get along with the floor and he's fine and so on. But
That is, and I may be jumping ahead, but I think that's one of the things that makes the violence so heart-wrenching is there are enough interactions that when Partridge is tarred and feathered, he makes a list of the men that did it to him and he names them. It's not just, oh, here's a group of men that just came after me and I don't know who they are. It's, oh yeah, there's the men that I traded with, that I walk past in the street, that I, you know, live next to, that I shop and I'm the same stores at, that I go to the same blacksmith, that he knows these men and they're the ones that beat him up and tar and feather him. But I might be jumping ahead. But what else? Yeah. What? Because
that's great. Let's jump in. I just wanted to get us for, you know, we often kind of gloss over the 2 years of trying and get to the year of failing. And failing may not be the right word, but the year of eruption. But it's a slow build up to that eruption. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I once calculated the approximate number of saints who were there and, you know, how many hours, how many days they've been there, that they probably spent like 1 million man hours of trying to build Zion, of putting in their farms and their. And so they're trying, and it's interesting because Partridge does get a little bit frustrated because people do show up and they're not prepared and they don't come, you know, by recommendation. He's like, please, let's do this in an orderly manner. Come if you have a recommendation from the bishop in Kirtland, New OK Whitney, but, you know, don't just show up and be like, I'm here, you know, surprise, here, help take care of me.
Because the revelation says that's how they're supposed to do it. It's by a revelation they're supposed to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. 1 million man hours. I mean, if that doesn't make it real, when we talk about the loss of their farms and their homes and things like that, that to think of 1 million hours of working lost and all of the money that the saints all over the place have sacrificed so much to purchase all of that land lost. It's devastating.
Yeah, it is. It is just heartbreaking. And I think sometimes we gloss over. I was reading, it was Sister Kimball's, Camilla Iron Kimball's, either an autobiography or personal writings or something. But she tells a story about fleeing from her home. And they just made, it was like 100 quarts. I think I made a note of it somewhere. But 100 quarts, they just bottled 100 quarts. It was like blackberries or something. And so she talks about, we left our home, we left our, you know, our possessions, our furniture, and the 100 quarts of blackberry, you know, and just that tangible, hearing all that work of just doing 100 quarts of blackberries left behind or whatever. I don't remember the exact fruit that it was, but it was, you know, it makes it more real that I think we sometimes forget, but
Yeah. And when you get these accounts of they're burning their hay and so on, and we forget how much work that was and how much they depended on that for their cows, which was a huge part of their survival. Right. You just hear burning hay. Oh, that's terrible. No, that's burning your livelihood and all the man hours you put into that. And anyway,
Yeah. Like you know, probably will move in the next few years, you know, closer down to BYU. And when I move, though, I'm not going to build my house from scratch. I'm not going to, you know, find a plot of land and, you know, literally me personally, like put the logs in and put everything in. And the saints, when they move, they're generally building their homes from scratch. And so you're not just leaving your home. It's like literally you've built it from scratch. And so
That's real.
Yeah. But yeah, they try and then things start to boil over in the summer of 1833. And there's tension, there's conflict. And eventually a mob gathers and there's a few different angles we can tell the story from. I think one of the angles that's to me is the most poignant is the children. And Emily Partridge talks about the kids gathering together in a home. And at first the men would gather together because they start realizing, okay, there's going to be some armed conflict potentially. So the men would gather, but the women and the children would just stay in their homes. They're like, we're safe. Like, who's going to attack women and children? Well, sometimes, or when they started shooting into and attacking and harassing the women and children left alone, then all of a sudden the women and children start gathering together. Partridge's home becomes kind of a center place. And Emily talks about the kids at the time, sometimes just waking up screaming like, the mob is coming. The mob is coming. And so they're gathering together and July 20th, Edward Partridge is home. His wife has just given birth. They've got a little 3-week-old son. He's got 5 daughters and now his son. He had a son that passed away at birth. So his first surviving son. And a group of men come towards the house, about 50 men. And Emily writes that her mom sent her and her sister to the stream. And I've always wondered if Lydia saw those men coming and said, I don't want my little girls to see what's going to happen. So she said, hey, go down to the stream and get water, you know, and the girls turn around, they see the men surrounding their home. And so they don't go back. And they wait, but the men come and they take Edward Partridge, who just goes with them. He's like, also, I think potentially saying, I don't want my family to see whatever you're going to do. So he's like, I'll come with you. He goes with these men, and they take him to the square and they beat him up. And they tar and feather him. And Partridge writes something. I have some of his own words as he describes this experience.
Is it all right if we, before that, is it right if we talk about like the meeting just before that where they give him time and so on, and then they go over to the Phelps home and all of that? Is it okay to set that stage as well?
Yeah.
And I can or you can, whatever you would rather.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. And you know it better than me, so correct me where I'm wrong, but they have called Edward Partridge and some of the other leaders to the courthouse, and they've said, you all need to leave. And he says, I'd like to be able to correspond with Joseph Smith about this. And I think he asked for 30 days. Is that correct? Or
they asked for, it's something like that, because it's like 30 days, and then it's like, okay, what about, you know, 2 weeks or 10 days?
Yeah, 10 days. Yeah. So he said, okay, we won't be able to correspond with them, but I'd at least like to talk to the other members around here. Can I have 10 days? And they say, you have 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes home. I believe that W.W. Phelps also runs home. Now, I'll remind our audience that we've talked quite a bit here about the literary firm and the importance that the church has placed in investing in this press that is just kind of, if you're at the courthouse, I guess if you're, let's see here, it'd be to the east, just a couple blocks east is where Phelps lives. And the second floor has the printing press where they've been trying to print all these things God has commanded them to print. They've been printing a newspaper. They've been printing the Revelations. And the mob goes there and they grab, now I've forgotten his wife's name. Sally Phelps, isn't it? And they grab her and throw her out. And the kids run out. They start to tear it down. And there's a child still in the house. And one of the mob members gets him and allows him to leave, but they're tossing the press out the top and then knocking the foundational logs out so that the house will fall. And this is where you get the story of, saving some of the Revelations. And you've got Elizabeth Rollins, who's and her sister are hiding with it and so on. Although other people, I think Phelps actually had grabbed some. And so it would have survived anyway. But you got to admire the absolute courage and conviction of those two little girls who are hiding in a cornfield, afraid that they will die. And so you talk about the point of view of the kids. This is serious trauma. If those Phelps kids will remember, I can't imagine that they won't remember this for the rest of their lives, that people come into your home and throw you out. And I think the account is that they grab Sally by the hair and they're tossing her in. Can you imagine seeing your mother do that? Or the Rollins girls hiding while men are threatening to kill them and hiding through the cornfield. This has to have a traumatic effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So did I get the story correct? Or
one detail on Mary Elizabeth Rollins and her sister, right? I think that's fascinating because Mary says to her sister, and they're like 13, 14 years old, or 13 and 12, somewhere right around there. She says, let's go get the commandments, right? They call them, they were going to publish them as the Book of Commandments.
Yeah.
What becomes the DNC.
Well, and all those revelations, they usually called commandments, right? That was what they called them. So sorry, keep going.
Exactly. Which I think people say, why'd they call it the Book of Commandments? Because people come to Joseph when they wanted a revelation, say, can you get a commandment for me?
Yeah.
And I want to know what does the Lord want me to do?
Exactly.
And her sister says, they'll kill us. And she's like, let's go get them. And I love, there's a great story, which maybe you've talked about with Mary, when she gets a copy of the Book of Mormon. So we're kind of jumping back in time here.
Yeah. Well, great. And we haven't talked about this.
Oh, okay. So she gets a copy from Isaac Morley. So they're living up in the Kirtland area before they moved to Missouri. And she borrows it. And her dad, Mary's dad, had died on Lake Erie, it might be, or Ontario, but he died in a shipwreck. And so she and her brother and sister and her mom live with her aunt and uncle, who are Sidney Gilbert and his wife.
I didn't realize Sidney Gilbert was their uncle.
That's your uncle. Yeah. So I know there's all these neat connections. Yeah.
So, and I'll just remind our audience, he's part of the, that United firm that is like the financial cow, as it were, the cash cow to, although not huge amounts of cash, but still the point of it is to be able to keep the literary firm going so that they're getting the Revelations published. So he had been a partner with Newell Whitney. And then he goes down with Isaac Morley and Edward Partridge and opens a store there. So they have a store in both places and this press and so on. I love Sidney Gilbert and his wife is Phoebe, right? So am I remembering correctly?
I wouldn't remember. I was going to say Elizabeth, but I don't know.
Oh, I don't remember either. It may be, it's Sidney. Sidney Rigdon's wife is Phoebe. So anyway, I love that family, and I didn't know that the Rollins were part of that family. Fantastic. So I interrupted you, but just such a great family. Keep going.
No, you're good. And it is fun. One of the things I think we forget about early church history is how everybody's connected to everybody else like that. You're like, oh, wait, I know this story. No, I know this story. And they're connected.
And everybody knows everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so Mary goes over and she borrows the copy of the Book of Mormon. And Isaac Morley says to her, I haven't even had a chance to read it myself. But you can take it if you bring it back before breakfast tomorrow morning. So she goes home and her aunt and uncle are like, what? How you could be so presumptuous as to borrow his book that he hasn't even read? And they stay up late reading it. She gets up early. You know, she takes it back and hands it to Isaac Morley. And he says, well, you probably didn't have a chance to read much of it, did you? She says, oh, yeah, we read all of First Nephi. And he goes, oh, well, you probably don't really remember anything, do you? And she repeats 1 Nephi 1, verse 1, and then outlines the structure. And he just kind of looks at her and he says, child, I can wait. Take this book home and read it. And she just had a love for the scriptures from, you know, when she first got the Book of Mormon. And so I think you see that as she comes and she looks at the Book of Commandments pages scattered about, that she says, those are the scriptures, those are sacred. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to, you know, most of us will not run into, you know, the street and grab pages of the commandments. But I think we show that we love them by how we treat them. Right. What's that verse in DNC 18:1 that you rely upon? They give you a commandment that you rely upon them. Here, let's actually read it. DNC 18:3, excuse me, where they're told, and if you know that they are true, the commandments are true, behold, I give unto you a commandment that you rely upon the things which are written, right? We show our love for the scriptures and how we treat them. And so, so Mary, she's one of my heroes. And she spoke at BYU in 1905. So that's kind of a fun connection.
She's fantastic.
Christmas time and in our day as well.
Fantastic.
So that's going on. I hadn't heard the part about a child being in the house or Sally being, you know, dragged by her hair. So I'd love to.
I hope I'm remembering that correctly. I heard Alex Baugh. I was with him in those places once, and I made mad notes as he told stories as they just roll off the top of his head. But that's one of the things I wrote down. So if I wrote it down correctly, then that's accurate, but who knows? But anyway,
but I have thought about your comment exactly of the children, and I thought about Sally Phelps as I talk about this with my students. I say, you know, maybe they probably didn't use the words PTSD, but how long does it take for you to be sitting in your house and not kind of have in the back of your head, is someone going to break down the door? Is someone going to come to my house and, you know, kick me out of the home? And apparently accounts of in Missouri, there was an account that said that they throw the printing press out the window, and it has those little tiny pieces of type, right? Every single letter is an individual piece of type. That they said for years, people found the little pieces of type in the streets just because, you know, you can go around and pick up every single piece.
I don't want to beat this to death, but as you talk about PTSD, this is not just a one-time event. I am sure they had that fear for years, but it's not that many years before they're kicked out again. Mm-hmm. And then not that many years before they're kicked out again. So that kind of thing really entrenches some traumatic responses in you. And I know the Savior heals them and they have support of family and saints around them. And that really, really helps. But there is no doubt this has an effect on the children.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And I like that you're mentioning the children, especially Eliza. So Partridge's oldest daughter, Eliza, she leaves her home in Painesville to go settle. That was a peaceable departure, but, you know, through her father's calling. But yeah, then they're kicked out of Jackson County. They're asked to leave Clay County. Essentially, the residents of Clay County, come to the saints and say, you've been here for 3 years after you left Jackson County. Can you please leave? We don't want to get up a mob. We will if we have to, but we don't want to get up a mob. Could you just leave? So then they move up to Caldwell and Davies counties. They're forcibly evicted there. They're forcibly evicted from Nauvoo. And one of her final diary entries, Eliza Partridge Lyman, is bought some land to build on. And I've just always wondered how those early days of being forced from her home made her crave in her later years. You know, so most of her adult life, she is in Utah, but she, you know, probably craved having a stable home. Yeah. She's a plural wife and, you know, struggles to support herself. And so you just think that, yeah, probably some long trauma. But like you say, the Savior can heal. And she always said, no, nope, like I support this church, this gospel, and like, I will go where I'm, you know, asked to go. And so jumping back to, yeah, then the events of July. And so, yeah, the same day that Partridge is tarred and feathered, the printing press is destroyed, the Phelps are kicked out of their home.
It was one of his counselors was tarred and feathered also, isn't that correct?
It's a man named Charles Allen, who we don't really know much about. And that's one thing I thought, I should study him and just write a little article about. Who is this other person? I think my sense is it's someone that just kind of is caught in the wrong place at the wrong time, because he's not one of the church leaders of the time period. He's just there, and it's him and Partridge. Partridge's wife actually writes that a lot of the church leaders had gone into hiding, knowing things were kind of brewing. But she says, my husband refused to go into hiding. He's like, I'm innocent. I haven't done anything wrong. I refuse to run and hide. And so he's gotten tarred and feathered. And I was going to read. He says, let me see if I can find here immediately, because he describes when the mob, here it is, says from his autobiographical writings, says, so the mob takes him about half mile away to the courthouse, the public square in Independence. They take off his hat, his coat, and his vest, and they're starting to take more clothes off, but someone, you know, he protests against being stripped of all of his clothes in the street, and someone says, you know, let him leave on his shirt and his pants.
Yeah,
and
one of the mob members.
Right? Yeah, which is, you know, pretty nice.
Yeah.
They put tar from his head to his foot and put feathers on him. And he says, all this because I would not agree to leave the county and my home where I lived 2 years. But then this is the part I think is interesting. He says, before tarring and feathering me, I was permitted to speak. I told them that the saints had had to suffer persecution in all ages of the world. I had done nothing which ought to offend anyone. If they abused me, they would abuse an innocent person. I was willing to suffer for the sake of Christ. But to leave the country, meaning that area of the country, I was not then willing to consent. He says, but by this time, the multitude made so much noise that I could not be heard. Some were cursing and swearing, saying, call upon your Jesus. Others were equally noisy in trying to still the rest that they might be able to hear what I was saying. And then we know the end of the story is tarred and feathered, but he didn't know. And so until after let me just read what he says. Until after I had spoken, I knew not what they intended to do with me, whether to kill me, to whip me, or what else I knew not. I bore my abuse with so much resignation and meekness that it appeared to astound the multitude, who permitted me to retire in silence, many looking very solemn, their sympathies having been touched, as I thought. And as to myself, I was so filled with the Spirit and the love of God that I had no hatred towards my persecutors or anyone else.
That's amazing.
Isn't that, and that doesn't just come in a moment, right? I mean, the Lord can give you an overwhelming sense of love to people. But I believe that he was able to feel that way because of how he had lived his life up until that point.
Yeah, I agree. And, I mean, he talks about, and I think it was true at the time that it mollified them to some degree. There was some compassion, but that didn't last, or at least didn't affect everyone, because the mob is out hunting people for quite a while. And it's a several month process of expelling the saints from Jackson County. One of the stories I always remember is that the Colesville branch is a little to the west of there, and also the Whitmers, and Oliver Cowdery is with the Whitmers. He's married into the Whitmer family, and there's a time where Oliver and I think it's David go into hiding, and William McClellan also goes into hiding, and he finds them out there. Mm-hmm. William McClellan is always like, okay, I believe, okay, I'm not so sure, I believe, I'm not so sure, right? And he's in and out. And at this point, he finds them, and he knows they're being chased. And at that point, Oliver and David are thinking, well, we're far enough out, maybe they won't get us. But they do end up expelling them. But he asks them, if I remember correctly, he says, I have never seen a vision like you two have seen. can you tell me, is it really true? And they both testify that they really had seen in vision what they had written that they had seen. And he says, that's enough for me, and sticks with them for a while.
Yes. Yes. And if you have any moment in your life that is probably going to be the easiest and the most opportune to say, you know, actually, I made it all up. I didn't see anything. You know, that would be the moment. And yet they both say, no, it's true. It's all true. Everything we said was true. And I think it's interesting. There's this another great quote from Partridge, and then we'll want to get you into these revelations too. But I think this background helps us understand some of the verses in 98 that so Partridge is Tarred and Feathered and Printing Press Destroyed July 20th. And then they say, we're going to meet again in 3 days. So July 23rd is then where they have the meeting where they say, okay, like, you need to decide, are you going to leave the county? Are you not going to leave the county? But before that meeting, Partridge says, my life was threatened by one of the headmen of the mob, saying if he lived till next Tuesday night, I should die. This was the day that set for their next meeting. Tuesday came, and while I waited for the mob to come and take me, I had many disagreeable sensations running through my mind. Like, I mean, what an understatement is that? they come and kill me. But in this really interesting and beautiful, I feel like kind of flipping the script, Partridge and five other men, as they meet with the mob on that Tuesday, the mob says, you know, okay, will you agree to leave the county? And one of the things they offer is these six church leaders say to the mob, here's a deal. You can take the six of us and you can do whatever you want with us. You can kill us. You can whip us. But just don't hurt anybody else. Promise you won't hurt anybody else. And so, and that's Edward Partridge, John Gorell, Isaac Morley, John Whitmer, W.W. Phelps, and Sidney Gilbert. And that,
the bishop and his counselors and the, what they call the church leadership would become the stake leadership, basically, right. So anyway, sorry, keep going.
No, thank you. Thank you. I had that thought. I was like, oh, we should mention who these people are. Right. And I think that gives some context as we look in DNC 98, when these men say, I'll lay down my life, that verse 13, well, let's do 12 and 13, DNC 98, 12 and 13. For he, the Lord, will give unto the faithful line upon line, precept upon precept, and I will try you and prove you herewith. And whoso layeth down his life in my cause for my name's sake shall find it again, even life eternal. And then 14 as well, be not afraid of your enemies, for I have decreed in my heart, saith the Lord, that I will prove you in all things, whether you will abide in my covenant, even unto death, that you may be found worthy. Right. And so for me, having that background, this is one thing I love about the Doctrine and Covenants. And I love that I get to study it, because we never all of a sudden say, oh, guess what? We just found the autobiography of Nephi's wife, right? We now have more background, but we do have the background of the stories of what's going on in the Doctrine and Covenants. And that makes, for me, it makes those scriptures just come to life. It makes them real. As I see, here's the stories of these early church members. So we'll come back to that. But I think.
And when he says that you may be found worthy, these men you just mentioned were found worthy. How noble is that to say, take and do what to spare others? That is Christ-like by definition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, it's how they were living their lives to say, you know, what can I do to further the kingdom? Like, I care so much. I care more about my individual family and the family of saints that, you know, just tell me you'll not hurt them. And they do agree, as I think we may have mentioned, that the saints say, okay, we'll agree to leave. Half of us will leave by January 1st next year, and half of us will leave by April 1st. But they hope that they'll be able to petition for government help and to be able to, not actually have to leave. And so that's kind of like this tenuous piece.
Yeah.
But Joseph Smith, so the interesting thing about this, DNC 98, right, Joseph may have heard some of what had gone on, but he wouldn't have heard everything. The seriousness of the situation wouldn't have been known to him except by revelation. And so DNC 98, the Joseph Smith paper's introduction says, hey, it can be talking about the conflict in Kirtland, and it can be directed towards the saints in Missouri as well. And so you see kind of this potential, you know, dual purpose, which I think also it's for us as well.
Yeah. This revelation is about 2.5 weeks after the tarring and feathering. And there's no way you can get word back to Ohio in that event. I mean, maybe if you've got a Pony Express kind of a thing, but typically it takes longer than that. So anyway, sorry, keep going.
Yeah, no, thank you. I love this. I like the back and forth, like, you know, bringing in, And I think, kind of as I think about DNC 98, I actually want to jump back briefly to DNC 9721, because they're trying to build Zion, and the Lord describes Zion in DNC 9721, where he says, "Therefore, verily, thus saith the Lord, let Zion rejoice, for this is Zion, the pure in heart. Therefore, let Zion rejoice, while all the wicked shall mourn." They're trying to develop into Zion, and that's really what they're building. And I think sometimes we get put down in a situation, whether it's a family situation or a ward situation or a work situation or a neighborhood situation, and we say, this is Zion, this is the best we can get, you know. But really, we're building Zion. Zion will come only as we strive to build it, as we become a holy people, you know, as we care for the poor and needy, that we eliminate poverty, and as we become, you know, individually and then unitedly righteous. Elder Christofferson has a great talk in 2008 about becoming Zion. But I think that it's interesting as we think about the idea of there were, you know, this is Zion, there were no poor among them. One of the definitions in the 1828 Webster's Dictionary of poor is of essentially, you know, not just like not having money, but of little value or worthless. And I think that the part of our ability to create Zion comes as we are able to overcome that and to not see anyone around us as, you know, quote unquote, poor, but that we are able to see the value in all the people around us. And so that's something I've been thinking about lately as well. How do we build Zion?
And it's an important part of what we're going through in the scriptures right now is how do we build Zion? Sorry, keep going.
Yeah, no. And I've been thinking about it because with the new semester starting, right, that's what I always, my goal is in our class is like, our class, I hope we create a little microcosm of Zion. I hope you don't just come in and sit down on your phone and look at your phone and sit up and listen to class and then walk out. But I hope that you look around you and say, who are the people around me? How can I reach out to these people here in this class or whatever situation it may be in? Sister, now I'm blanking. Sister Craig, who talked about the story at General Conference about not looking at her phone in line and talking to the man and saying, you know, oh, you have a cat. And it was his birthday. And she said, because I just put my phone down and just was able to pay attention to the people around me. You know, that's Zion right there in, you know, Walmart or Costco or wherever she was.
And you're absolutely right. And that's what it should be. When we are pure in heart, we see people as children of God. And thus, none of them are poor in the sense you were talking about, right? They're not worthless. Mm-hmm. They're not of lesser value. And I think that is an essential component in building Zion.
Yeah, it makes me think of Elder Bednar gave a devotional at BYU about being quick to observe. And he talked about that the Spirit can help us see the good and the evil in ourselves and in others. You know, to be warned of, okay, there's evil, I need to stay away, but to see the good in other people, to see their potential. I remember, you know, sometimes as I look at my students at BYU, because as you mentioned, this is my first time or first semester as a full-time assistant professor, but have taught for the past 3 years a full-time load. And I just remember looking at one of my students one day, and it was just like for a moment, he was making a comment or something. And it was like I could just see into the future and I could see, you know, what he would become. Not necessarily, you know, this is exactly what he'd become, but kind of potential. This is what he could become. And it was just one of those moments where I felt like the Lord let me kind of see these are the people you're teaching. These are the wonderful you know, C.S. Lewis says to live in a society of gods and goddesses that, you know, that's what we will become. And that's what the Lord, I feel like, is trying to teach them in these sections where they've just, you know, had these terrible, terrible experiences. Is it later on, Partridge says, there's a letter. Let me see if I can just grab that letter. When he writes after the Saints do eventually get kicked out in October, November of that year, Partridge writes a letter to Joseph and he says, I hope ere this, you know, I hope before this, there may have been a comforting word from the Lord through you. But be this as it may, I'm anxious to hear from you, right? They want that comforting word. And you see that in DNC 98, where the Lord says, verily, I say unto you, my friends, fear not. Let your hearts be comforted. Yea, rejoice evermore and in everything give thanks. that I think, and well, we can come back and talk about, but verse 2 as well, waiting patiently on the Lord for your prayers have entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabbath and are recorded with the seal and testament. The Lord has sworn and decreed that they shall be granted, right? That sometimes we want our answers right now. We want our prayers like answered and problem solved immediately, but sometimes we just need that reassurance that the Lord has heard us and that mm-hmm. he's aware of us.
And there are so many interesting things of that. Maybe I'll just touch on one just there in verse 2. But first of all, I want to set the stage in the way that you're talking about. This is a section that we should all read whenever there is a difficulty, a trial or something. Again, we may not be getting tarred and feathered. We may not be getting kicked out of our homes and having to go live on the frozen ground with no covering, or some people are living on, they dig in little holes or, you know, into the hillside to live in, and some in old barns. I think Edward Partridge lives in an old barn and so on. But we may not have that happening, but we have stuff happening, and we can go and read this. Now, I'm going to read verse 2 again, and I want people to think of verse 2. I mean, what these people have gone through and are going through and will go through for the next few years. And have that in mind and think of how that might apply to whatever it is you're going through. I'm just going to, you mentioned the Lord of Sabaoth. That is the phrase for hosts or armies. Like, I think the best translation of that is the Lord of armies. Mm-hmm. And when he says that, he is reminding us, I do have power and I will come. It's a second coming kind of phrase. I will at some point come with my hosts or my armies and make all of this right. But that's in the future. I just want you to remember who I am when I'm talking to you and what I will do. So keep that in mind as we read this again and think of your own trials and say that, well, I'll read verse 1 and 2. Verily I say unto you, my friends, fear not. Let your hearts be comforted. Yea, rejoice evermore, and in everything give thanks. So hard to do when everything is falling apart, as it sometimes is in everyone's life. Waiting patiently on the Lord, for your prayers have entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth and are recorded with this seal and testament. The Lord hath sworn and decreed that they shall be granted. Now, we know that's not going to be for a while. Maybe it's all in the second coming. I don't know. But still, that's so powerful. He says, be comforted, rejoice, because maybe not this moment, but eventually I come and I make this right. So you should be giving thanks right now and rejoicing right now, because you know, if you really believe and have faith, you know, eventually I take care of all of this.
I love that. I love that. Thank you for adding that in. Because as I read that, I was like, oh, I know it's not Lord of Sabbath, but I'm not sure how to pronounce that. So thank you for sharing that interpretation. I didn't realize that it means hosts or armies. So
yeah, that's yeah. Cool. And it really is a second coming kind of laden kind of phrase. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it makes me think about how when the Savior came the first time, people expected him to come with the armies, like right then, like, okay, great, deliver us from Rome. Here you go. Come on. This is what you're supposed to do. And he doesn't. He says,
wait patiently.
Yeah. But sometimes I think we think like, okay, come deliver me right now from my trials. And yet he says, no, like everything will come, like in verse 3, like all things wherewith you have been afflicted shall work together for your good. Like it will work. It will be okay. As I was rereading these in preparation to chat with you today, I remembered, as I read verse 1, of giving thanks. Remember Elder Uchtdorf, then President Uchtdorf, gave a talk, and I pulled one quote from it. He talks about being grateful. And he says, I might have mixed up all my pages here. Basically, the gist of his talk, I must put it somewhere else. Here it is. He says, so I thought of Elder Uchtdorf, then President Uchtdorf's talk from April 2014, where he says, it's easy to be grateful for things when life seems to be going our way. But what then of those times when what we wish for seems to be far out of reach? Could I suggest that we see gratitude as a disposition, a way of life that stands independent of our current situation. In other words, I'm suggesting that instead of being thankful for things, we focus on being thankful in our circumstances, whatever they may be. And I've just always remembered that. They said it's good to count our blessings at another part in the talk. He's like, we can count, we can be thankful for things, but just this idea of just being thankful in our circumstances and not just, oh, I'm grateful because I have X, Y, and Z blessings.
Yeah.
And so it was another thing that I was thinking about.
And that's powerful. I know, I mean, looking at this, and I'm not comparing myself to them at all, but I know when our family had its greatest trial that we've had thus far, I should knock on wood somewhere, but that I was very comforted and immensely grateful that I could keep turning to God. I prayed more than ever before. They were more heartfelt prayers than ever before. But there was real gratitude and comfort in knowing I can turn to God. There's nothing I can do about this particular situation, but there is someone I can turn to. That's beautiful. Again, we want people to jump into the scriptures themselves. And I hope what will happen for our audience is that because of the stories that you've told them, that these verses will be real. And if, again, there was persecution occurred then, and God's probably speaking to both groups. He's like that. He can cover a multitude of things in one sentence. But I hope that we will read that thinking of them, just really dive into these verses, this whole section, but especially these first verses, and see how it applies to you in your trials as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes me think, I spoke to a big group in the Smithfield House about, I don't know, 17 years ago or something. I was pretty nervous. It was by far the biggest group I'd ever spoken to. It was part of a state conference. And I had a brother that was at BYU and he said, I'll come. He wasn't in my stake, but he said, I'll come. I'll just come and be there, you know, just kind of cheering for you reverently. Yeah. And I just remember sitting there and thinking, you know, I just want to know that my brother is here. And then that gives me, you know, comfort, like, okay, my brother is here. And it just made me think about our Savior, of just how knowing, okay, our brother is here and that he's watching out for us. That sometimes we don't need him to solve, like, yeah, sometimes we want him to solve it, but sometimes it's not that we need him to solve the problem, but we just want to know that he's there, to know that, like in verse 2, our prayers have entered into his ears, that he sees us, that he hears us. And that's what I think he's doing here is, or one of the many things, like you say, he can do a lot with a few words in scripture, that he's saying, I see you, I hear you, I love you, and like, I've got this, it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The timing may not be what they were hoping for, but he does got this.
Let's see, there's so many things. I was like, how are we doing on time? There's so many things we could talk about.
Yeah, well, we have a little bit more. Maybe I'll just, while you're collecting and figuring out where you want to go next, maybe I'll just let my audience know the plans for... We always do a little bit of bonus material on our Patreon website, and I'm going to actually talk about how this Missouri era forms Orrin Porter Rockwell. Everyone loves to know Orrin Porter Rockwell stories, and what we're talking about this era is kind of what makes, I mean, he already had some dispositions, and we can talk about that, but this is what makes Orrin Porter, it makes Port, right? And so we'll talk about that, and then on our little daily thoughts we do on our Patreon website, this will be my second week of going through, I was just reminded of this as we talked about Lord of Sabaoth, I've been going through some stuff I learned as I was preparing an education week, a series of lectures on the second coming and how to be prepared for the trials of the second coming. This will be the second week where each day I'll have a thought from what I learned as I went through that intensive study. So everyone can look forward to that on the Patreon website. Go to tsar.website, tsar for the scriptures are real.website. Anyway, hopefully that allowed you to gather your thoughts and we can keep going.
Yeah, well, a few different thoughts kind of popped up into my mind, and this is something I think you could comment on better, but I think, you know, interesting to share the verse 18, where the Lord says, let not your hearts be troubled, for in my Father's house are many mansions, and I have prepared a place for you, and where my Father and I am, there you shall be also. I remember when someone first explained to me the biblical practice of, or practice in biblical times of building on to your father's home when you got married. I can take a stab, but I feel like you would probably explain it better if you want to.
I'm happy to. So especially during the Savior's day, and like, for example, we have lots of examples of this in Capernaum, which is where he spent a lot of time during his ministry. So we know what's happening there and so on, but it was a common thing, what we call insulae, where you'll have someone who builds a house and it has a little courtyard, and then you just keep building around and onto that. So you're surrounding the courtyard and more houses. So it becomes basically a family compound. And you'll go out to the courtyard, and that's where you'll have like grinding stone and stuff. And people would make the meals together. And I don't know how much everyone ate together, but sometimes significant portions of them were eating together, maybe sometimes all of them. But even when, if they weren't going to eat together, the women were out working together and so on. But you had that, what became an increasingly, a whole bunch of little houses that were all really part of one large house that had large family units together where they could take care of and support each other. So yeah, when you say in my father's house, there are many mansions, I think this is part of what is being drawn on. And the idea that we are part of God's family and God's household once we've made a covenant. And covenant is mentioned a number of times. I always have to shout out covenants a number of times in this section. And once you are part of the covenant, you're part of God's household, and he's going to have this place for us to have each other's backs. But in the end, ultimately, it's him that has our back.
Yes, I love that. I think I knew you would explain it much better. But I just love that imagery. And when somebody explained that to me, I thought, oh, this makes so much more sense now. In my father's house are many mansions. I mean, I prepared a place for you. So yeah, I love that. There was verse 8 I was thinking about with, well, actually, okay, I keep thinking about this. So can I share a quick story? You mentioned Orrin Rockwell. There's just a funny story as they're crossing the plains in 1847. This comes from Mark Saker's book, Hearken, O You People, which is the historical background and setting of Joseph Smith's Ohio Revelations. And it's kind of in a footnote tucked away. But it's from, I believe, the journal of a man named Horace Eldridge. He gets woken up. You know, the night guard comes to him, and it's Orrin Porter Rockwell and one of the Johnson brothers. I always forget if it's Luke or Lyman. I think it's Luke. But they come and wake him up, and they say, hey, there's a mule choking. We can hear a choking mule somewhere here in camp. We can't find it. Like, will you help us? Like, trying to figure out how we can help this poor choking mule. So they start looking around, and they realize it's actually not a choking mule. It's Bishop Newell K. Whitney snoring. He sounds like a choking mule.
That's so funny.
And it says, there's this line in his journal. It's like, it turned out to be, you know, Bishop Newell K. Whitney snoring somewhat to the annoyance of some of the camp. No harm done, but ended in a little sport. So I just wondered, did I like throw water on him or what? But I think about this, and this is one thing I love about studying the Doctrine and Covenants, is we can hear kind of some of the backstory. Like, we never know, like the Nephi snore, I don't know, you know, but we can hear stories about church. And to make it real, you know, I picture a family pulling up, and they pull up their wagon, and the wife looks over and she's like, oh, honey, like, you parked next to the Whitneys. He snores really loud. I don't want to park next to the Whitneys. And the husband's like, well, we can't move. Like, we're already parked. Like, it'd be rude to them. She's like, I just really wanted to get a good night's rest tonight. You know, like, this is real life. It's like the Lord is taking these real situations and saying, okay, I see who you're working with. And like, we're going to help you. We're going to get you.
And I'm sure Port did not let that go without some kind of something going on.
Right? So, I can imagine. I know, like, ended in a little sport. But you know, that's the real life. That's the, you know, where the rubber meets the road, as we take these revelations that the Lord has given and we say, okay, what am I willing to do? And Partridge, so this summer after he's tarred and feathered, like a month later, he writes a letter back to his friends in Painesville. And he says, among other things, I am willing to spend and be spent in the cause of our blessed master. That, you know, he says, yep, this is what happened to me. But I'll do whatever the Lord asks of me. And just keeps going. I think it's in his patriarchal blessing or his daughter's description, one of those two, I'm forgetting which, but says you'll serve in this office until really you have the desire to resign from it, just because it will be so hard. But he doesn't, he just keeps going as bishop until he passes away in Nauvoo. Yeah.
And really he passes away because he's worn himself out. I really think if you want to describe someone who wears themselves out in the service of the Lord, it's Edward Partridge.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Just this whole life is, what can I do to serve? There was another quote I wanted to share from him as they come. Well, I don't know. Do you want to jump and talk a little bit about 99 and 100? Do you want to jump to 101? Well,
maybe let's just do one more verse in 98, if it's okay. And then if we get to the others, great. If not, that's okay as well. But I just want to read verse 12. For he will give you, well, let's do 11 and 12, because 12 makes more sense in light of 11. And I give unto you a commandment, that ye shall forsake all evil and cleave unto all good. Oh, isn't that good advice, right? Deny yourself of all ungodliness is another way of saying that. Or Isaiah says, cease to do evil, learn to do well. And then he says, though your sins be as scarlet. That's the next thing he says. So all sorts of ways God says this, but forsake all evil and cleave unto all good, that ye shall live by every word which proceedeth forth out of the mouth of God. For he will give unto the faithful line upon line, precept upon precept, and I will try you and prove you herewith. And whoso layeth down his life in my cause for my name's sake shall find it again, even life eternal. I wasn't planning on reading that last verse, but as I saw that verse and remembered it, and we just were talking about Bishop Partridge, I mean, wow, this applies to him, but I hope it can apply to all of us. But this idea that God gives us things to do, he's going to give them inspiration, right? That's the every word that proceeds forth from the mouth of God. They'll get inspiration from the prophet, but also personal inspiration. And God is giving them a little bit, and if they keep doing it, then he'll give them more. And while that's wonderful, it will also be God trying and proving us. And so it doesn't mean that when we follow inspiration, everything's going to be easy or dandy or perfect. It means God's going to keep leading us along, helping us to dislike evil and love good all the more. As we had in section 88, that light cleaveth unto light and truth unto truth. That's what he's trying to get us, is to become the kind of beings that forsake evil and cleave unto good. And some that will inevitably have to have painful things in it. And he's just proving to see if we will do it. But the way this ends, if we keep up with it, is eternal life. And that's a pretty good deal.
A phenomenal deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, so.
No. That actually makes me think kind of the verses where the Lord is talking about the law of the land. He says, you know, you should do what I command you. And then verse 4 and then verse 5, that law of the land, which is constitutional, supporting that principle of freedom, maintaining rights and privileges, belongs to all mankind and is justifiable before me. And then verse 6, he talks about befriending the law, which is the constitutional law of the land. He does encourage them to say, okay, they seek redress. Joseph says, seek redress. There's in fact a whole book, right, of the redress petitions, which, you know, and later as well, dealing with the expulsion from Missouri, but where people try and use the government and established rules to help them. Partridge actually brings charges against the people that beat him up and tar and feather him. And he wins the case and he's awarded damages of 1 cent. So it's kind of like the judge is like, I can't really rule against you, but I'm going to kind of, you know, it's like a slap in the face. It's like, really?
It is.
I can actually give you anything. As I mentioned, it is, you know, and it's sobering because he has this big long list of all the men that he knows personally that are the ones that did it to him. And I've got to imagine, okay, so they live there, so that's July 20th, and then it's the end of October, beginning of November when they do leave, when the mob kind of rises again and then forces the saints literally from the county they're supposed to have until January 1st and April 1st to leave. But when the mob members get word that they're trying to seek redress, that they're getting lawyers, they're going to try and fight back legally, they just drive them from the county. But what were the interactions like, you know, for all of August and September and October? Sparge is like, well, I need to go to the blacksmith. And it's like, oh, yeah, I'm not saying specifically, but, you know, there were people that he interacts with and he knows they were there. They know they were there. They may know that he knows that they were there. And yet, how were these interactions? I don't know, but just they're living in that same society for the next few months. But Partridge writes in a letter in November, if we are delivered and permitted to return to our homes, it must be by the interposition of God, for we can see no prospect of help from the government. Like they were trying. But then he says, I'm of the opinion that unless God works for his people and displays his power in some way or another, we cannot return to the land again. That the saints, I just kind of see the echo of, as the people are writing to Joseph Smith, because as you pointed out, right, Joseph is in Kirtland, they're in Missouri, and the only way Joseph knows what's happening, in addition to direct revelation from the Lord is through letters or people coming and visiting. And so you see kind of those echoes of these revelations where the Lord says, like, I will take care of things in my time. And the saints in Missouri saying, okay, that's really, I think, the only way it's going to happen, because there's no way for us to make it back otherwise. And they never do in their lifetimes make it back to their lands in Jackson County. Yeah. But a good number remain faithful.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, we'll probably have to start to wrap up. I mean, there are so many other stories and so many other amazing revelations that are part of this, and we can't do them all. The John Murdoch is, as we said, is another hero. And we'll see if I have time to do a second bonus material where I talk about John Murdoch, because I just love that guy and all he goes through. This is the John Murdoch, not only that was part of the mission that we talked about, but whose wife died at the same time that the Smith twins died. And then they bring in his children, and Joseph and Emma are taking care of them. And one of them dies when Joseph is tarred and feathered, or shortly thereafter, and so on. John, the baby. Anyway, it's fantastic stories that we're not going to get to, but we'll give you a last few minutes to wrap up in any way you'd like to.
Sure thing. Well, can I add one thing on John Murdoch?
Please.
And then I'll wrap up. One thing I think is really poignant. We talk about, his wife passes away, and then Joseph and Emma adopt the twins. He actually loses two more wives.
Yes.
His next wife dies. And, you know, he remarries like 5 years later. She dies the next year. And then he remarries the next year, and she dies like 7 years later. That he just so much loss in his little girl, Phoebe. He's promised that your children will be protected. He gets it to Missouri, and then his daughter is fine, and then she dies shortly thereafter.
And I guess we could also say that's part of, with these other revelations, that's part of your theme of family that you were talking about, that God keeps giving them instructions about their family and taking care of their family as you go on your mission after you've made sure your family's okay. Because he doesn't have anyone to take care of his children, and the mission he'd already gone on, he gets back and finds that his children aren't okay, and some of them have been taken away, anyway, down to Missouri and so on. So there's sacrifice, 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 and God's also saying, I'm mindful of your family. So I think that ties into your theme as well, and we'll ask our audience to just look for that as you study these sections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good thoughts. Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. I think with kind of, I don't know, just thinking about kind of overall thoughts is really coming back to, that theme of family, that is DNC 100 is Joseph and Sydney on a mission, and just worrying about their families, and just their desire to know that their families are okay. And I just love that the Lord cares enough about us to reassure us. He could have said, hey, don't worry about it. Like, I'm taking care of it. I'm not going to tell you anything. But he gives them the reassurance in verse 1 of section 100. And we can end with that. It says, verily, thus saith the Lord unto you, my friends, Sydney and Joseph, your families are well. They are in mine hands. I will do with them as seemeth me good, for in me there is all power. That we may have family members that we worry about, and that really they're in the Lord's hands. And I remember praying about somebody that I was worried about, not actually a family member, but someone I cared about, and just having a really strong feeling of the Lord saying, you know, they're my son, and I'm watching out for them. I'll take care of them. Everyone has their agency, right? In section 99, it talks about receiving and rejecting, right? We all choose what we're going to do in our own individual relationship with the Lord. But we can receive that reassurance that the Lord cares for us, and that he cares for our families, and that he's watching over them, and that he loves them even more than we can, even more than we realize. And that's one of the things that I'm very grateful for with the revelations, is how they help me see who the Savior is. They help me see his loving kindness and his reassurance and his mercy, and the way that he not only loves me, but loves all those that I love and everyone else as well. And I'm grateful for that.
That's beautiful and just powerful. It's such a beautiful ending. I should just let it end there, but you've reminded me of two stories that I have shared on the podcast before, but I think they bear repeating. They're just, for me personally, at least, so powerful. I'll have to do it. I'll also say I did look up, when you said Sydney, I looked up Sydney Gilbert's wife's name. It's Elizabeth. But anyway, so.
I'm glad we resolved that. I feel like it's important. You got to remember her name too. So thank you.
There are a lot of Elizabeths running around in these stories. So that, it was a very common name at the time. Anyway, I also remember one time praying, just pleading with the Lord and saying, please help my daughter. And getting the strongest answer, she was my daughter first. I, of course, I'm going to take care of her. She's my daughter. And then a colleague of ours who shared a story with me that where he said that he was praying and praying for his children and said, I've done everything I can to save these children. And getting the very strong answer, you don't save these children. That's what I do. That's my job, and I'll do it. And that's worth remembering, those two things. As you said, they are his children. Our family is his family, and he's the one that's mighty to save. He's the Lord of Sabaoth, and he does hear our prayers, as we've said. Just thank you for sharing all this and making it all come home for us. That was beautiful and wonderful, Sherilyn. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for letting me be part of this. I appreciate it.
It's just good, clean fun. It's a pleasure. We also want to thank our audience, and we'll plead with you to share this with people. Please do it online. We'd love comments. We'd love, you know, downloads, likes, reviews, and sharing online is great. But more important, share with someone individually, if possible, in person, but in whatever way you feel inspired to share. But find someone that you share something you learned with, that you were inspired by or about, and share with someone in some way. We want to thank those who help us. Everyone helps us, and we're grateful for everyone. I want to mention in particular one of our recent donors who became one of our executive producers, James Park and his family. They've been so kind and helpful in a number of ways. Really, really wonderful supporters. We're grateful for them, but just grateful for everyone. And today, especially grateful for the spirit we felt as you've taught us, Sherilyn. So thank you, and thanks to all.